for argument, the United States versus Schroeder. Ms. Clinton.
May it please the Court. My name is Leonard Goodman. I represent Mr. Schroeder. And Mr. Schroeder was a stay-at-home dad who worked out of his home preparing tax returns for a large volume of clients. And he was charged with tax preparer fraud, and he pled guilty, admitting that he helped his clients cheat on their taxes. In short, by inflating Schedule A deductions for things like medical expenses, charitable expenses, business expenses. There was no agreement as to sentence in his plea agreement. And like many defendants in the federal system, the most critical stage of his criminal proceeding was his sentencing hearing. There were two issues presented at his sentencing hearing. One was the issue about the tax loss attributable to Mr. Schroeder, which of course determines his guideline range. The second issue was whether Mr. Schroeder's parental responsibilities were extraordinary and took the case outside the guidelines. Although this was a resentencing, all of the information that was presented to Judge Dara at the resentencing was new information that had not been available at the prior sentencing. And I don't believe there's any dispute about this fact. The government does make the argument that there is a waiver issue, which I'll address briefly, in that the cases cited by the government are all on waiver are all distinguishable, because in all of those cases you have either a defendant who took a direct appeal and didn't raise a particular claim on that direct appeal, and it was considered waived on remand, or you have a situation where the defendant did make the claim on direct appeal, this court heard it, rejected it, and sent it back for another purpose. In addition, in this particular case, because the government never made this waiver claim in the district court, it's reviewed for plain error, and it's our position that this court's remand order, which was that the judgment was summarily reversed and the case remanded for the limited purpose of resentencing, that Judge Darrow did not commit plain error.
There wasn't really a first appeal here, was there? I mean, wasn't the first appeal cut off before it ever...
That's right. Required. This is, in effect, his first appeal. His first, the prior appeal was aborted and summarily reversed. The dispute over the tax loss centered on a civil audit, or a course called a correspondence audit, which at the original sentencing hearing, all that was known about this correspondence audit, all that had been provided by the government was a spreadsheet, which showed that revenue agents of the IRS had audited 52 tax returns of Mr. Schroeder and made a determination that there was $267,000 of underpaid taxes and that this was all attributable to Mr. Schroeder. That's what was known at the first sentencing hearing. The underlying documents of that civil audit had not been reviewed and was not available to the defense. At the resentencing, the defense had an opportunity to inspect the civil audit and look at all of the way that the civil agents arrived at that conclusion, and was able to make an argument that the government had not met its burden of proof. But the issue here in this appeal is really whether the defendant received his constitutional due process right and statutory right to dispute these relevant factors at his sentencing hearing. And there's two things that we point to in the brief, and I'll just address. The first is that the lower court began the sentencing hearing by announcing its finding about tax loss without any input from the defense, without asking if there was any evidence to be presented or any additional arguments to be made.
Well, wait a minute. He had the pre-sentence report that had that information in it. And your client had the opportunity to object to that pre-sentence report.
We did, and we filed written objections. So we had our position from the written documents.
And he had reviewed those.
And he had.
And then at the hearing, he allowed you or your client to introduce evidence about the disputes that he had with the.
Right, but the But before allowing us to present any evidence or argument, he announced his finding. He announced that.
So the judge says, here's what I think it is. Show me that it's wrong. What's wrong with that?
If you look at his words, that's not what he said. He said, I've made a determination that the amount of loss is $428,555, so let's proceed. At which point, I asked to present information, and the court did allow that, and I presented an offer of proof from Agent Zakota, who was there in court. And the offer of proof was in effect, and this was stipulated by the government, that this correspondence audit, which was not conducted by the criminal agent, it was conducted by the civil branch of the IRS, that they took 55 suspicious returns, they identified problems, they sent letters to the taxpayers indicating that we are disputing these deductions. If you can authenticate them, come on in and do so. In many cases, the taxpayers did not come in and contest those deductions. In other cases, they came in and there was a brief interview. There was no review of Mr. Schroeder's files. There was no review of the receipts that the taxpayers sent in. And in fact, it wasn't really their intention to determine whether it was Mr. Schroeder's fault or whether it was the taxpayers' fault. They were just concerned with collecting back taxes.
But those deductions were of the same type that were shown to be fraudulent in the criminal investigation.
Well, but there's a big difference between the way the criminal investigation was conducted. In the criminal investigation, the agent did review Mr. Schroeder's files, did interview all of the taxpayers, and made a determination that this amount was $167,000, and that amount isn't disputed.
It showed a pretty evident pattern, and each one that he looked at, virtually each one he looked at, the same types of things happened.
Well, I don't know that's correct, that there weren't situations in the criminal audit where the agent determined that he could not attribute this to Mr. Schroeder. And, in fact, the agent had testified that he was conservative in his views. And I don't know the exact methodology that he used, but it's clear that he did his homework and he reviewed all the files and that we did not dispute that. His assertion that the government had approved beyond a reasonable doubt that criminal audit was reliable information and could be relied on by the judge. There's a vast difference between the civil audit, which was simply for the purpose of collecting back taxes. And in response to this argument, the lower court stated, I agree with you, if the standard here were proof by a preponderance of the evidence, that might pose some problems. Now, there's no dispute here, and the government concedes that it was required to prove the amount of tax loss by a preponderance of the evidence. And it's our position that the judge's comments clearly indicated that it did not apply the correct standard of proof, and it further suggests that had it applied the correct standard of proof, that the result would have been different. If I may, the second issue, the last issue, is the issue of the extraordinary parental responsibilities of Mr. Schroeder. He was a stay-at-home dad, had a special needs infant who could not be placed in daycare. And here we were asking for a below-guideline sentence on behalf of the special needs infant who would suffer from Mr. Schroeder's incarceration. And this all was new information, again, because at the original sentencing hearing, all that was known was that this adopted child was born to a drug-addicted parent and had drugs in her system. At the new
those are difficulties that many families face when a member is facing sentencing, correct?
That's true.
How was this different than the ordinary situation?
Well, again, Judge, our position on appeal is not necessarily that the judge was required to agree with us. And certainly he could have said that this is not extraordinary and it doesn't take the case outside the guidelines. But what the judge was required to do was to consider that it has been recognized as a valid claim. The judge was required to consider it, and if he was going to reject it, to indicate his reasons for doing so. But the judge's reasons for rejecting it was simply that Mr. Schroeder chose to commit this crime, and therefore it's his fault that this child's going to suffer, which of course is true, but it doesn't answer the claim that we raise, and that's the issue here. We're not saying that the judge had to agree with us, but simply that he had to consider the claim, and by his sole comment about it, it's clear that he did not. He rejected it on an improper basis and not on a proper basis.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Goodman. Mr. Lee?
Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Stephen Lee, and I'm appearing on behalf of the United States in this matter. The defendant in this case could have raised his challenge to the
Lost Mountain. Your plain error waiver stuff, ridiculous. You have blown it twice now. Right? Your office, which has very good resources and has terrific lawyers, you missed the maximum sentence the first time, and in the second time, you know, you missed the waiver point. So why should we be bailing you out, right? You've got more resources than the other side. You shouldn't make these mistakes.
We should have.
And anyway, there's no prejudice to the government from this, right? No harm to you for having to defend, you know, 10 minutes or right.
Well, the reality is that there wasn't any first appeal. It was aborted before it ever took place. So I don't really see that anything was waived. Isn't that true?
Well, the defendant could have raised the...
Well, how could he waive? I mean, the judge said, well, we're going to send it back. That's the end.
He could have continued with the briefing of the loss issue based on what happened at the first sentencing hearing. The first sentencing hearing did include discussion of the loss, and the defendant should not have been allowed to use the accident of remand to reopen that issue.
So you mean after we decided to reverse, he should have continued briefing? A little unusual.
It would have been a little unusual, I agree. But it would have dealt with...
Do you have a better argument than your waiver argument?
Well, in any event...
To make to us, or do you want to just...
In any event, the district court did not commit a clear error.
Well, I don't understand. I mean, this is a real cascade of errors by Judge Darrow. He starts off by making his determination before he hears the evidence. Then he gets into this tremendous confusion between the burden of proof by a preponderance, and the admissibility of evidence. And he seems to think that if evidence is admissible, then you take it to be true. Right? That doesn't make any sense. And look, the fact that a bunch of people are determined to owe back taxes doesn't prove that the preparer committed fraud, right? They could have committed fraud or it could have been an honest error. So you have that whole... And then when it gets to the last point, it's quite true. As Judge Tinder said, you know, these are common kind of sob story things and the judge is not required to buy them. But he can't say categorically this is inadmissible. That's the old guideline regime. He can't do that. So you have this cascade of errors.
Let me go through those. To begin with, Judge Darrow did begin the second sentencing hearing with a discussion of what he had found.
It wasn't just a discussion. He says a determination. Then he's also surprised when the defendant wants to offer evidence, and he kind of puts it in, you know, he's going to let it in as an offer of proof, you know, which would ordinarily be something for an appeal. I don't know what's going on here.
The defendant had an opportunity to review the PSR before the second sentencing hearing. The judge gave him court-appointed funds to have an expert to review the correspondent audits that were the basis for...
Well, what's the purpose of having a hearing if you're going to announce your conclusion first? You know, sentence first, verdict next? You know, Alice in Wonderland?
The judge stepped back and did allow the defendant to...
Yeah, but why did he start off making his determination? He didn't say, this is my tentative view. That would... As Judge Tinder would suggest, that, of course, fine. You know, this is my tentative view. You tell me why I'm wrong. That's fine. Instead, he says, I do find that the initial amount is. I find that the total amount of loss is. And then after he says that, he says, and I should note, Mr. Porter, you did a very fine job. So in other words, this is the end, saying thank you very much. And I don't know why I said Mr. Porter. I think he meant Mr. Goodman. Anyway, Goodman says, Judge, if I may, you know, let me finish. And that's when the judge said, you know, he's going to, yeah, that offer will stand as though his testimony were elicited here in open court.
That particular statement related...
The judge treated it as if, having made his decision, he was going to allow the lawyer to complete the record for an appeal. But anyway, that's not the least of it. The most of it is this confusion between burden of proof and a standard of admissibility. That's very serious. Can't you say the standard is not a preponderance, that the evidence had sufficient indicia of reliability? Well, that makes it admissible. That doesn't make it credible.
This judge's statement came up in the context of discussion about the what information he could consider for the sentencing. The defendant has focused on
look,
the specific
he could issues. Consider it, but he couldn't say, I don't have to find by a preponderance of the evidence. Right?
He did not make that, but he did not state that.
He did say that. He did say that.
He was focusing about whether the information that he could rely on had to be reliable by a preponderance of the evidence.
That doesn't make any sense at all. There's no such thing as reliable by a preponderance of the evidence.
And that's why
it's either admissible or it's inadmissible. It was clearly admissible. The question is, was it credible? And even if you get over that, look, there's a big difference between not paying your taxes and being a fraudulent preparer.
Circumstantial proof submitted to the court established by preponderance.
No, all it established was that there were people who, customers of this guy, of your defense, Schroeder, who don't pay their taxes. Now, it's very likely that much or most of that underpayment was due to fraud. That's fine, but you can't just take the whole amount and say, well, if it's underpaid, it must be fraud.
The defendant had pled guilty to preparing at least 52 fraudulent tax returns, and the IRS, in conducting the correspondence audits, had interviewed nearly all of the taxpayers whose returns were audited as part of that correspondence process. Both the defendant's initial supplemental sentencing memorandum and the government's sentencing memorandum are consistent on that nearly all taxpayers were interviewed, or that only several taxpayers were not interviewed. So the IRS did have the benefit of having actually reviewed the returns and speaking with most of the taxpayers whose returns were being audited, and thus were able to reach their
But that's the first batch. That's not the second batch.
No, that took place in both batches.
No, because all they were interested the second time, or correct me if I'm wrong, all they were interested in was whether the taxes were underpaid, not whether they were the figures were frauds by the preparer.
But in doing so, the agents were able to see similar fraud to what had occurred in the first.
Well, look, if you inflate your deductions, it's going to look the same whether you, the taxpayer, did it or the preparer did it. So you have to have some evidence that the preparer did it. So you could have had affidavits from the taxpayers who said, well, the preparer said I can do this, right? And they didn't have that for the additional returns that jacked up his sentence.
The IRS conducted interviews with those taxpayers. There were no affidavits, but there were interviews with most of the taxpayers whose returns were part of the correspondent audits. In addition, the
so
tax
what?
Other category,
so they interviewed them. So what? Did the interview show that these were had been suggested by Schroeder?
During the interviews, the taxpayers who were interviewed said that they were not aware of how those deductions came about. That were part of the.
Well, what does that mean? They don't want to admit having done it themselves, or what? And did the judge discuss? Where did the judge discuss these issues?
The judge did not go into detail.
The judge didn't. He didn't go through any analysis of this question. He just treated the underpayments as automatically frauds due to Schroeder. He didn't say, you know, this and that, and they interviewed him and all that. He didn't say anything of that, did he?
No, the judge adopted the recommendation of the probation, which incorporated all the amount of the correspondent audits.
And did the probation service go through this analysis that you just have?
The probation officer talked to the IRS agent who had been working on the case and was provided some information about summarizing the correspondent audits.
And what did the probation service say?
It concluded concluded that the amount was of the correspondent audits was appropriate to be considered as relevant conduct.
Because the taxpayers had been asked about the frauds?
I don't know if the record, if the PSR goes into that level of detail. I see my time is up. If I can make just one more point.
Sure, of course.
Just the idea that it wasn't just the correspondence audits that the court was considering. It was also the defendant's guilty plea that he pled guilty to causing at least 52 of these false tax returns and that.
Well, how do you reason from the fact that someone pleads guilty to X that he's also guilty of Y? Is that your argument?
He pled guilty to one count, and with which is based on just one return, but the rest of it would be considered relevant conduct, both in terms of the criminal audits as well as the correspondent audits.
Yes, but the question is whether those were frauds. Look, let me ask you, what about the last? Are you going to defend the judges saying that he couldn't consider family circumstances?
I don't think the court was saying that he could not.
What do you think he was saying?
I think he was rejecting the defendant's particular argument.
Why?
Family circumstances.
And what reason did he give?
I think based on the idea that these family circumstances were not particularly unusual.
Oh, did he say that?
I'm not sure he went into that specific, made such a specific statement.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Lee. Mr. Goodman, does he have any time? Yeah. Have anything further?
I have nothing further unless the court has any questions.
Do you have any questions, sir? Okay, well, thank you very much to both counsel. And you were appointed, were you not, Mr. Goodman? Well, we thank you very much for your efforts on behalf of your client, and we thank Mr. Lee for standing up to the barrage of questions. And the court will be in recess until